This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien and Chris Sullivan. I'm sure you've heard the reporting on the latest book co-authored by Bob Woodward called Peril, in which he talks about General Mark Milley, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, being very worried during the end of the Trump administration about whether he would, A, start a war with China, or B, use nuclear weapons. CBS News military analyst Jeff McCausland has taken a look at that, and I got to say that, of course, we don't know. I mean, did these conversations take place as portrayed in the book? We don't know. But the idea that somebody who, according to people around him, was sort of losing control could simply pick up the phone, order a nuclear strike, and have it happen is kind of terrifying. Would it really work that way?
Well, it could potentially, Dave. And by the way, welcome back. It's great to hear your voice.
Thank you.
That's a system we established back during the Cold War to vest all this power in the President of the United States. That's why a military officer follows the President around wherever he goes with the so-called football, a briefcase full of nuclear codes, to deter the possibility of a surprise attack that the President then could order a launch-on-warning attack. So he certainly has that authority, and Donald Trump, for example, retained that authority up until the moment Joe Biden was inaugurated on the 20th January of 2021. Certainly appears from, as you suggest, from Woodward's book, this was a concern of General Milley's, perhaps not so much ordering a nuclear attack, but precipitating a crisis, whether it was with China or whether it was with the Iranians, that might then escalate to a level where nuclear weapons could be considered. On the other side, of course, at least as described in the Milley book, or in the Woodward book, I should say, the Chinese were very worried about a surprise attack. And don't forget, even during the most peaceful of all presidential transitions, our allies and potential adversaries find this disquieting as we hand this enormous responsibility from one individual to another.
There's no room for context here. I mean, there's no room for people to exercise judgment and say, "What? Why would it be in the United States' interest to open a surprise attack on China when we depend on them for such a large part of our economy?"
Well, that's exactly right. And Milley, in the piece, and as reported by Woodward, brought together senior military leadership and specifically talked to them about the procedures for the use of nuclear weapons and that he would be involved in the process. But according to the letter of the process, he is not necessarily involved. The President of the United States can certainly consult with his senior advisors if he's making such a momentous decision. And obviously, it would seem logical that a president would consult with his senior military advisor, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. But there is no absolute requirement. Secondarily, of course, Milley, if he was contacted, could advise against such a thing in that capacity. And number two, he could advise military officers, and he seemed to be suggesting this in his meeting with the senior leadership, that they should only follow legal orders. Officers, of course, swearing an oath to the Constitution of the United States and not swearing an oath to a specific president.
Mm-hmm. Okay, now the only experience I have with the nuclear chain of command is the movies I've seen about it. So is there no role for human judgment once the president issues the order with the proper code? The two guys just turn the keys and the nukes go off? Or can somebody say, wait a second, I'm not going to turn my key because I don't consider this a lawful order?
Well, that's exactly right. And that's the other part of it. An officer is instilled with the notion that, you know, it has to be a legal order. And, you know, this actually has happened once before in our history. It didn't involve a military officer, but in the waning days of the Nixon administration, when a lot of people were concerned about the stability of Richard Nixon right prior to his resignation. A lot of reports seem to be now verified by history that he was drinking a great deal. Then Secretary of Defense Schlesinger actually contacted the senior military leadership, very similar to what Milley did, and in fact tell them if there was any question by the president or any effort to do anything involving nuclear weapons, nobody would do anything until they contacted him or the National Security Advisor, Dr. Kissinger. Again, you could argue usurping part of the authority of the President of the United States, but doing so at a moment when there was some concern about the president's stability.
Right. Now, let's talk briefly about NATO. Is it falling apart? Because, of course, there seems to be a trust issue because of the way we left Afghanistan, and the French are now unhappy because we and the British conspired to take away that submarine contract from them. I mean, and they seem really upset. I think it goes beyond canceling the little gala the other night. So what's your assessment of NATO's position at this point?
Well, I think NATO certainly has to be repaired and refocused. I mean, clearly during the Cold War, the focus was the Soviet Union. It's not like a huge enemy to bring you into kind of a unified view of life. And then after that, the focus became for a period of time the Balkans. And we had the wars in Bosnia and Kosovo, which threatened the actual territory of the NATO countries. And now, of course, then became the war on terrorism after the attack on the United States. Now, with those particular threats either gone or more diffused in the case of terrorism, is there a unity of purpose that we now can find? Certainly, it was damaged, I think, by Mr. Trump, who criticized NATO repeatedly and talked about the United States not living up to its responsibilities. Mr. Biden came into office, said, you know, the United States is back, NATO's back. But I think the allies are trying to say, well, tell me how that works. Tell me what tangibly that means. And with this withdrawal, and you're right, the French are very upset losing this $90 billion contract for these submarines, that NATO has to be damaged. We've got to find a focal point, a lot of work ahead to repair the damage that's been done.
Okay, is NATO's situation bad enough, and this is the key question, I think, that Russia would see an opening and move into those little countries which it would dearly love to dominate?
That could potentially happen, and there's a lot of concern about that. There's no doubt about that. The U.S. has a lot of military force presence. We rotate through places like the Baltic Republic to ensure the rate that the Russians understood that even in, almost immediately, if they were to cross a border, that they would be confronted by U.S. or NATO forces, which could then precipitate a lot of different things. I don't think so right now, frankly. I think the Russians have enough of their own problems in a lot of different places. And furthermore, they might understand, I think, that this moment when that is a perception, all the more reason why NATO might respond much more vigorously and therefore move us towards a crisis of dramatic escalation.
And you're confident we would actually respond if Russia did that? Because, I mean, they got away with Crimea.
Got away with Crimea, but of course, that wasn't a NATO country. That was part of Ukraine, no doubt about that, number one. Number two, of course, now the concern, this was the so-called hybrid warfare, a combination of cyber warfare, little green men. And then last but not least, one of the problems with the Ukraine and Crimea was that the fact that the vast majority of the population of the Crimea is, in fact, Russian. That doesn't make it right. That certainly is still a violation of territory we haven't seen since the end of the Second World War, but perhaps in some people's mind, made it a bit more palatable.
CBS News military analyst, retired Army Colonel Jeff McCausland. Jeff, thank you.
Always a pleasure, Dave.
And more on the fallout, apparent fallout, from the Bob Woodward book on Trump's last days in office. Apparently, a group of Democrats have been negotiating with the Biden White House on proposals that have been described as a point-by-point repudiation of the ways that Donald Trump was able to run the presidency. They've combined these bills in a package called the Protecting Our Democracy Act, and among the things they're trying to do is make it harder for presidents to offer or grant pardons in situations that raise suspicion of corruption. Presidents could not ignore oversight subpoenas. They could not spend or secretly freeze money contrary to congressional appropriations, and they would not be able to fire inspectors general or retaliate against whistleblowers should these bills pass and be signed. It often seems that Seattle City leaders are always divided, but earlier this month they all agreed on one proposal honoring some local heroes. With that story, here's Cairo Radio's Hannah Scott.
The murder of 28-year-old Gabrielle Garcia is one of the darkest moments in Seattle's history.
Domestic violence in public when it's usually not. It's usually behind closed doors.
Senior Deputy Prosecutor David Martin leads the office's domestic violence unit and says this tragedy unfolded in the middle of the Seattle food court at the Armory in 2018 when 28-year-old Gabrielle Garcia, who had ended things with David Morris and obtained a protection order against him just days earlier, met with him for a visit with their 5-year-old son, Gerald.
She had done everything right.
But it wasn't enough, and the father of her child pulled out a knife and attacked in front of their young son and a food court in Seattle's center full of people. Employees and other witnesses jumped into action, shielding the young boy and later doing all they could to save and comfort Gabrielle as they waited for first responders. As Morris left the food court, still armed with the knife and his hands bloodied, he was followed by a civilian with a concealed carry permit who kept him held at gunpoint until police arrived. When the killer was sentenced earlier this month, Martin explained why he was asking city leaders to recognize the heroic efforts of those who were there that day.
I think when people go on social media and they look at what's going on in the community, and sometimes they feel bad. They feel like no one is helping. And it just so struck me in this case that every single person rushed in and risking their own lives. They did not know Gabrielle. They didn't know her at all. And here is everyone someone who is working at Mod Pizza immediately. It was on video, like runs to go help her and try to save her life. People throughout the Seattle Center trying to stop David Morris as he is armed, leaving. The police who ran into the scene and immediately worked with Gerald and immediately tried to save Gabrielle's life. And it speaks to some of the police officers who had added medical training and deployed that because every moment that went by was incredibly serious. And they were not able to save her, but they tried desperately. And there is just something about our fellow community members putting their own lives at risk to save someone they didn't know. That is just like, it's an incredible thing. So just as though, you know, this case showed the worst of what domestic violence is, it's so public and in front of a child. It also has this aspect that it shows the best of people.
A tragedy that shattered part of Seattle, but also brought it together in a way we don't see every day. And earlier this month, it also brought our city leaders together. Seattle Mayor Jenny Durkin and the entire city council signing on to a proclamation praising the heroic efforts of all of those who were there that day, including Seattle police officers.
Well deserved. Colorado's Hannah Scott. Choke Points, brought to you by Primary Residential Mortgage. Washington's Good to Go tolling system got an upgrade earlier this summer, and now the first bills and statements are coming out since the upgrade, and Chris is going to tell us what you need to know.
And I got my first good-to-go statement via email on Saturday, and I was a little afraid to open it because I thought it might be spam or a phishing attempt because I really wasn't expecting an email from good-to-go. But it's legitimate, and so if you were a little worried about opening it up, it's the real deal. So what you're going to have to do is when you get that, you're going to be asked to log into the new good-to-go website, if you haven't done that already. Once you get there, you'll be asked for your username and password, and then you will be needed to change that password immediately so you can get into the system. Now, the first thing that I noticed is how user-friendly the new website really is. I mean, I was able to check my balance, my tolling history, make changes to my notifications without much effort at all, and that's what this upgrade was all about. The tolling division's Patty Machado says it's about giving users what they want.
When we designed the system, we took feedback from customers through the years, and so we did our best to center that design around the customer experience to make it, to improve it.
The goal is for the 2 million good-to-go users to be able to handle most issues online without having to use the call center.
There's a learning curve for customers. There's a learning curve for the call center, too, as well. Just everything is new and everything is great as far as the tools that are provided, but there is a bit of a learning curve associated with it.
Now, as these first good-to-go account holder statements and bills come out, Machado says the call center has seen an increase in activity.
We get a lot of calls from customers who are on the website for the first time, and they're just trying to learn how to navigate it. We do ask for patience because we know it's going to be busy, and we're going to see longer wait times.
My suggestion is just to log on to the new website, just kind of browse it for a while, just kind of look around and check it out. Shouldn't really take too long to get dialed in. It is really user-friendly and pretty intuitive. For those of you that use the pay-by-mail system when you take a toll road, your first bills from the new system will be coming out in the next couple of weeks. And Michonne says what you can do is you can actually convert those pay-by-mail bills and save money by creating an account.
Say if you get a pay-by-mail bill and you say, hey, I want to save $1.75 per toll, and I want to get set up on a pay-as-you-go account or a prepaid account, you can do that online, and you can convert those tolls into the good-to-go rate, the cheapest rate.
I was able to change my billing to the new pay-as-you-go option, which is one of the new features for the website and for the system. It allows your credit card to be charged every time you use a toll road, and you don't have to keep that $30 balance. So I'll see how that works, and if I don't like it, I can always change it back with a simple click on the website. So this upgrade is good. It works really well. At least it did for me, and it should make things a little bit easier for us.
So did I hear that correctly? If you had been on the pay-by-mail plan and were being charged a much higher pay-by-mail rate, you could go back and claw back your money by signing up for the automatic?
Well, with this, yeah, when you get this first bill, you won't be able to go back all the way and get those $2 back per. But what you have on this statement, when you get it in the mail, what you'll be able to see there is you'll be able to go in and create an account, put in that information. Mm-hmm. And then if you become a user, yeah, that $2 per toll by pay by mail goes away, and you then become a good to go account user. So you still would have to sign up and do all those things if that's what you wanted to do. But yeah, you can convert that bill to the cheaper rate if you want to. That's one of the things that you can do with the new system.
How often do you get free money from the state?
So not often.
That's pretty cool. All right. Now, for people like me who, I've got the sticker and it's been working fine as far as I can tell. I almost never look at the website. In fact, I don't think I've ever looked at the website. So do I have to do anything?
You should. You should log on. They recommend that you check your account once a month if you use the tolls. Mm-hmm. If you use the just to make sure everything's okay. Well, the one thing I ran into before the system upgrade this summer was my credit card that I had on there had expired. I hadn't put in my new information.
Right.
So, you know, and the other thing you should do is you should just go in, log in, create a new password so you're in the new system, and just check it out. I mean, that's about the only thing you really have to do, or I would recommend you do is go in, log in, and then change your password on that account just to give yourself a little extra security. And then you can look around to see if you want to do anything different. The pay-as-you-go is going to be kind of interesting, whether or not you like keeping a balance or not in Good2Go.
Why would somebody want to hack my Good2Go account so they could get my bills? I don't get it.
Well, because they get your credit card information. They might pick a password there. Well, yeah, because they can go in and they would find the credit card that you have stored in there if they were able to get into your profile. And then the password that you use, if you use that for multiple sites, I know some people use the same password.
I didn't think
for
they displayed the
thing.
Full credit card number anymore.
Well, like but if you go into your profile, you might be able to at least to get a couple numbers out of it. And then, you know, hackers are smart. They piece things together with just snippets of information.
They are smart.
Just get into the website and check it out, and I would update your password, Dave, for sure.
Okay. And it's time for Hannah Scott to join us this morning with an update on homelessness. Apparently, we're going to see a visible difference in the number of homeless people on the streets. Also, we have the eviction moratorium expiring, and that could be trouble for people who are going to be kicked out of their homes. So, Hannah, what's the latest?
There's a lot going on housing and homelessness. I'll start off with Mayor Jenny Durkan, who made the announcement yesterday about another big investment in affordable housing.
In June, we stood together to announce a $28 million of Seattle Rescue Plan money would go towards the rapid acquisition of properties. And today, we are proud to announce the first awards for those rapid acquisitions. With joint city and Washington state funding of $50 million, we've acquired three brand new buildings with a total of 165 new rent and income restricted studio units that will serve individual and young adults experiencing homelessness or at extreme risk of becoming homeless.
So that's where that visible difference comes in. This is permanent housing. So this is people who are ready to get off the street. And then by doing that, it kind of empties up room if they were at shelters for those other people who are now on the street. So that's where the visible difference comes in. Here's where the buildings are.
These buildings are in the transit-rich Capitol Hill area with easy access to jobs and services. Today's investment means that tenants will be able to move into these brand new homes this fall. Right now in Seattle, before the pandemic, it took about 3 to 4 years to complete new developments and cost over $350,000 a unit. This ability, this anomaly in the market that Emily Alvarado and others recognized and were able to take advantage of, gives us immediate ability to house people at a lower cost.
So this is money. It's a split between the city, but those city dollars are actually from the American Rescue Plan. So,
and how much was that again?
$25 million on the city's part, and then another $25 million from the state, some of the stuff that the state legislature had done.
That works out to about $303,000 per unit.
$50 million is what the city's doing. So here's what happened. These were buildings that were permitted and ready to come up. They're new buildings on Capitol Hill in 2019, pre-pandemic. But then the pandemic came, and then the market tanked for these micro studio apartments is what they were going to be. So they were sitting there. So they found this one kind of opportunity to get these three buildings that were sitting there empty, and Lehigh, the city will own it, but Lehigh will manage it. That's the low housing.
What I'm getting
at
is I'm just wondering how sustainable this is. So this will house 160, these are small micro units. That's 165 units equals 165 people. But we've got what?
It's certainly not going to solve everything. So this is like back in June. I was at her prior announcement when they announced like $28 million in investments for another building. And I asked her, I go, you know, is this going to make a difference? Are we going to see a visible difference? How soon before everybody's off the street? And she was, you know, straight. She said it's certainly not going to do it all, not this one buy, but this is one step. And we've got to, these are things we can do now, and these are things we can do faster than the usual permitting years-long process, right? Where she was saying it would take 3 to 4 years to get this stuff done. These buildings are built, and these people will be in them by the end of the year. So that's faster. So I know it's not instant, but it's definitely faster than what we've seen in the past. And for those of you keeping score, Councilmember Andrew Lewis was out there, and he kind of tallied up what we've been doing so far this year.
We've done more of this in the last year and a half than, honestly, in the preceding decade, at a scale, at a level of intensity, with a level of energy and commitment that all of us share to get through this crisis of housing and homelessness in our city.
And I know it doesn't seem that way, but there's, I can't tell you the number of investment kind of press releases that I get that come out of the mayor's office, or even the county for that matter, where they're kind of chipping away, right? They're putting money over here, over here, over here, and they're opening up this many beds here, and it's going to all collectively add up. And you're still going to be 3-4 years out probably, though, to get this big, big visible difference where everybody's off the street, if everybody kind of toes the line and keeps going in this direction.
Right. And now what about preventing people from becoming homeless in the first place?
So the clock's ticking. We have yet another eviction moratorium that is about to expire. This is the bridge gap moratorium that the governor put in place when our full moratorium expired back at the end of June. Essentially, this says if you're a renter behind on your rent, as long as you're making some sort of effort to deal with your landlord, make an arrangement of some sort, for even if you can't pay right now, to pay down the line, then you cannot be kicked out. Well, that will expire in 8 days. The reason that that was put in place is because there's such an incredible lag on getting these federal rent relief dollars out for both the landlords and the renters to help them. And there's still that lag. So there is a lot of concern from some about this leading to mass evictions, including from Representative Nicole Macri, who pushed hard to get the extension the last time and likely will again this time.
I'm very concerned that people still need protection. I think we need to continue to protect people from eviction. We have stood up rent assistance programs across the state. They have gone slower than we would have liked. And that's in part because we're standing up a brand new kind of social support system that's never existed before and doing it at an enormous scale. And so while our governments have been working quickly and working with their community partners to get resources out, they haven't gotten out fast enough. And at the same time, the federal unemployment programs have ended. And I'm hearing from many constituents who now remain unemployed and have no unemployment. And so I'm very worried about the prospects of a lot of people getting evicted in the months to come.
And so there are discussions right now going on with the governor and his staff to try to possibly extend this again. That is not good news for your landlord groups. This is Jim Henderson. He's with the Rental Housing Association. Now, he's concerned about that possibly being extended. He's also concerned about what will come up at the Seattle City Council today and later this week. Three proposals, including rent control.
Is also a problem. I mean, we're losing housing providers quickly. And those housing providers who have left the market, sold their property, have said it is because of the regulation that was handed down at the state level, but then also at a local level. So we know that more regulation has an impact on and incentivizes housing providers to leave the market.
And I've talked to that. I think I've told you before, Dave, I've talked to a few of them who've left the market, sure, taken their stuff out of state after they sell their places. And of course, the problem with that is that it shrinks the affordable housing supply, which we were already way behind on to begin with. There are also two other proposals coming up at City Council. One that would mandate 180-day notices to the renter if you're going to raise the rent. They're very concerned about that as well. And then another that mandates that you pay relocation assistance if you're going to raise rent in a way that, wow, your tenant cannot pay.
Well, that's going to kill the market,
right,
for people buying rental homes. I mean, why would you do that?
These are all three from Shama Sawant. Don't know how much legs they have. They'll start coming up today, and I will keep you posted.
Now, on the people running out of unemployment, my understanding is that, we hear every day about jobs going begging.
Lots of jobs.
That's what I mean. So why does there seem to be such a terror because unemployment's ending? There should be jobs everywhere.
Because there were those jobs, the federal unemployment, the extra unemployment ran out. So sure, people can go and get their jobs. They weren't doing it, whether they were all not doing it because they were, gathering that unemployment and just kind of hanging out on the couch. Who knows? Mm-hmm. But for whatever reason, there's a massive labor shortage in all kinds of industries, small to large, and there's no extra money for those who might need it. So, nobody believes that everyone is just kind of hanging out on their couch, choosing not to work. So somewhere in there, there's going to be a gap. And on top of that, again, there's a massive lag and slowdown in getting these rent relief dollars out to people that are coming from the federal government because there's so many rules and things that the feds put in place for them to follow. So we need all of that catch up together so that everybody gets what they need, gets their job, and hopefully we shift everything back to the way it was, which wasn't that great to begin with.
Yeah. Hannah Scott, thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
It's time for your daily dose of kindness now. It's brought to you by Robert W. Baird & Company, Incorporated. It was 6 years ago, Seattle CEO Dan Price made a shocking announcement. He'd been cutting his $1 million salary to make every employee, himself included, a minimum of $70,000 a year. Well, CBS's Carter Evans has an update on his employees.
New parents and co-workers Carrie Chen and Alex Franklin can't wait to introduce their son to colleagues at work, a company they say made it possible for them to begin a family in the first place.
And you weren't the only ones that had a baby, huh?
No, everybody had a baby.
So it's a baby boom here. Why do you think that's happening?
We can afford it.
They both work at Gravity Payments in Seattle, a credit card processing company with a CEO who 6 years ago did something that shocked everyone.
And we're going to have a minimum $70,000 pay rate for everyone that works here.
You had people making $35,000 a year, but you told them you were going to double their salary.
Yeah.
And then you actually had to do it.
Right.
How did you pull it off?
Well, it's tricky. I took the $1 million pay cut.
That's right, a $1 million pay cut. Dan Price was simultaneously hailed as a hero and eviscerated as an enemy of capitalism.
Why aren't more companies doing this?
I would say that's the failure of this. I feel like I've been shouting from the rooftop, like, this works, everybody should do it. And zero big companies are following suit because the system values having the highest return with the lowest risk and the lowest amount of work.
But Price thinks Gravity's returns are up in large part because bigger paychecks have led to fiercely loyal employees.
Our turnover rate was cut in half. So when you have employees staying twice as long, their knowledge of how to help our customers skyrocketed over time. And that's really what paid for the raise more so than my pay cut.
Price says Baby Thomas is one of 60 new additions to the company family over the past 6 years. He also claims the number of employees buying homes has gone up tenfold.
We are right on track for the American dream. We have a beautiful baby boy, a wonderful home, a beautiful life. We're not only just living, we're able to thrive.
That is Carter Evans reporting.
And somehow Dan Price gets by without a yacht or his own plane. I don't know how he does it.
Somehow he's still smiling, yes.
Seattle's Morning News, Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien and Chris Sullivan. And here is our sports insider and star of the Mike Salk Show on 710 ESPN, Mike Salk. I'm still pinching myself to be talking about the Mariners still playing games that count this late into September. They won again last night. I guess what fans are wondering is it safe to really get their hopes up now?
For this year, no. Probably not. I mean, it's a fun story, three games out, but with so many teams in front of them, I mean, the problem is every night you win, you need so many good teams to lose. You need the Yankees to lose, the Red Sox to lose, the Blue Jays to lose, the
A's to
lose.
So they do not control their destiny at this point.
No, and unfortunately, things kind of got away from them about a week ago. They lost, a couple of games to Arizona and a couple to Boston, and that was I don't want to say that was all she wrote, but that ended their real serious run for this year. There's an outside shot, and what I love about this baseball team is they're not going to give up. We've seen it all year long. They just keep fighting and scratching. But no, it's probably not safe to get your hopes super up for this year. What it is safe to say, though, is, wow, this team overachieved this year. They started a complete teardown and rebuild after the 2017 season. I think my expectation was that by 22, they would start to be good, and 23, they would really compete. And what it seems like today is that they're a year ahead of that.
Yeah. Well, from my point of view as a casual fan, I can say they are fun to watch and fun to listen to in a way that previous teams definitely were not, because they always seem to be in the game. This would be great timing, though, because the All-Star game's coming.
2023. Yeah, so you got a year, and by then
it could line up with a great season.
Yeah, what's interesting about this year of, you know, sort of moderate contention versus some of the others is that the others were kind of built on house of cards. You had some veteran players that you're paying a lot of money to, right? Nelson Cruz, Robinson Cano, etc. And underneath that was nothing. There was no farm system. There were no young players on the way. And when they decided to make that decision to tear it down, that has now changed. Now they have a good team. And they have the best farm system in baseball. They have lots of young players who are on the way. Their whole rotation at AA, so two steps away from the majors, should all touch the majors within about a year.
Yeah.
They've got Jared Kelnick, Julio Rodriguez, both top five prospects in baseball. So when you put those kind of names with what you're already doing at the major league level, you're really close. There's one last step, though, that needs to take place this offseason, and that is they got to go spend some money. And by all accounts, they plan to do that, whether it's through the free agent market or whether it's through some trades for some names of guys that are already established. I would absolutely look for the Mariners this offseason. That doesn't mean they're going to go crazy and become the Dodgers and $250 million, but they will start to really add some veterans to compete.
I think what's really fun is that sometimes players you'd never heard of just step on stage and become standouts. Like I was watching the highlights from last night's game. Tyler Anderson, pitcher I'd never heard about, did really well.
Yeah, so he was one of their trade deadline acquisitions this year. He was a guy they got to kind of help get them over the top as their rotation was starting to struggle down the stretch. And it turns out he's been really good, and maybe he's a possibility to re-sign here next year. Another name that I'd put on that list is Ty France. When he was acquired a little over a year ago, I don't think anybody here had heard of him, but Jerry DePoto had recognized him as someone that he targeted for acquisition. And since he's been here, he's been one of the best hitters in baseball, and he's still, I think only 26, so just now coming into his prime. You know, you add a couple of hits like that to your Jared Kelnicks and to your Julio Rodriguez's and your stars, and that's how you build something.
So you talk with Pete Carroll about the Seahawks loss. I was thinking, at least they didn't lose with a walk-off safety, which they came very close to doing. But what was his diagnosis?
You know, I've talked to Pete, I don't know how many times over the course of doing the Pete Carroll show and when Brock and I used to do our show together. And I would say that Monday was about as urgent as I've heard him early in the season. He didn't seem happy. And usually Pete kind of comes in and, you know, we're like apoplectic over a loss. And Pete's like, you know, calm down. And by the end of it, it's like, oh, Daddy Pete made everything feel okay. And I did not get that sense yesterday. Not that he's worried, but he was really upset about penalties. He even talked about benching guys, which is something I've never heard from Pete. He alluded to what he needed from the quarterback position, which was more on the final couple drives of the game where Russell, unfortunately, didn't give them much. And I don't disagree with him. Look, I love Russell Wilson. I think he's one of the best quarterbacks in the game. I can love him and be mad at him at the same time. I think he'll do better the next time. But I watched that game Sunday, and I put it on Russell's shoulders. I know the defense gave up 500 yards, 200 on the ground. But when you're all, you know, franchise quarterback, elite franchise quarterback like Russell gets the ball twice with 6 minutes or less, and all he needs is a field goal to win, he's got to convert on that. That's the expectation for someone like him. And unfortunately, in two chances, he couldn't do it.
Mike Sauk, star of the Mike Sauk Show on 710 ESPN. Thanks, Mike.
Thanks, Dave.
And on Tuesdays, we go live to the nation's capital and Pulitzer Prize winning reporter David Farenthold at the Washington Post, who has been on the Trump beat since we first started talking to him. And when was it? 2016? My gosh. 2015. It's been a long time. So how much, let's first of all get an update on your latest piece, which is how much taxpayer money is still going to the Secret Service to protect not just the president, but apparently a bunch of people. Are they actually worried about death threats?
Well, so this is the way it's supposed to work. When the president leaves office, the Secret Service protects him and his spouse for life. But if he has adult kids, if they're White House aides, they once the president's out of office, they're on their own. But Trump did something that no president had done before. He extended 6 months of Secret Service protection for free to his adult children, of which there are four, and three top White House officials. And he never explained why. You know, there was no public decision, no public order. It just did it. And so what that meant was the taxpayers spent about $1.7 million over the first 6 months to protect a bunch of millionaires, people who were going on business trips, going to Cabo for the weekend, you know, going on ski trips, mm-hmm. living a very high-style life with free taxpayer protection.
And this is money that could be going towards infrastructure? Is that what you're telling us?
Well, $1.7 million, sadly, in the world of the government is not that much money. The interesting thing about this, I think, is just that it was so unexpected. So they had to send agents and spend money on people that normally are never protected and could honestly pay for their own protection.
Yeah. Now, given your interest in Donald Trump's finances, I saw a story that a treasure trove of apparently tax records was found in a basement somewhere. Are you familiar with that?
Yeah. So this is something that came out yesterday. There was a preliminary hearing in the case of Trump's CFO, Alan Weisselberg, who was indicted for tax crimes back in July. So they're having a preliminary hearing to talk about, you know, let's schedule the trial, let's talk about discovery in this case. And Weisselberg's lawyer said that they had that the government had recently found tax documents in somebody's basement, in a co-conspirator's basement. We're still trying to figure out what that's about, but I think it relates somehow to Weisselberg. And it's not.
And explain who Alan Weisselberg is again.
So he's this longtime CFO. I mean, we're talking three decades CFO of the Trump Organization. Mm. And what he was charged with basically was orchestrating a tax fraud scheme within the company where he and other Trump executives would hide a portion of their compensation from the government so they wouldn't have to pay taxes on it.
Right. Now, is he still in Trump's good graces, or I mean, could he be dismissed as a disgruntled employee?
Well, he appears to be in Trump's good graces. He is still working at the Trump Organization, doesn't have the high power that he used to. And he seems, you know, from all we've heard, he is not – the prosecutors really want him to flip and turn on Trump and offer testimony about Trump to help himself. But so far, he has not agreed
to that. He has not. Okay, the other story, and I'm not sure if you're following this or not, but there's been a Justice Department investigation into the Mueller investigation. You're familiar with that, right?
Yes.
And there was a story that broke, I guess, last week of an indictment of somebody. Basically, the thrust of the story is that a lawyer who worked for Hillary Clinton apparently lied about his status, so the FBI just didn't know he was working for Hillary, and may have deliberately planted the story that Trump was in cahoots, or the campaign was in cahoots with Russians.
Well, in many ways, this investigation led by Alfred Durham, who was a U.S. attorney, is now a special prosecutor. It's kind of like the mirror image of the Mueller report, in that everybody on one side, in this case Trump's side, believes they have these huge hopes for it. You know, it's going to end with all these people in handcuffs. It's going to find all this horrible wrongdoing. And much like the Mueller report, what it's found has been pretty minimal so far. They indicted one FBI lawyer for falsifying some part of a document that wasn't that important. Yes, and in this case, this guy who was a lawyer for Clinton, he was talking to the FBI about something that people were concerned about in 2016, which was this weird sort of internet server traffic between a Trump Organization and a Russian bank. I don't think anybody has ever found any reason to believe that that was suspicious or that it means anything. But people on the Democratic side were pushing it then. And he brought it to the FBI, which is fine to, you know, say to the FBI, look at this. Should you investigate? But the FBI, he's being charged with sort of misrepresenting one piece of that story, which was, who was he working for? Was he just doing this on his own, or was he representing, the Clinton campaign? And they say that he told them he was working on his own, but really he was hiding that he was working for Clinton. So it's a pretty small distinction. And
you're sure it's small? This is not the smoking gun that proves Hillary was behind all this?
No, I mean, it's so minimal compared to the hopes that had been raised. I mean, this was supposed to be not an investigation of Hillary Clinton or her lawyers. This was supposed to be, you know, finding the wrongdoing by Mueller and his people and to prove it was all a witch hunt. You know, none of that's come out. Instead, this guy's been, you know, working on it for months and months and months. And this is, you know, the biggest thing he's found.
Yeah. I see that some Democrats are actually trying to make sure that if ever another Donald Trump gets in office, he can't blow off subpoenas and stuff like that. I haven't seen much coverage of this, but it's called the Protecting Our Democracy Act, and it would control the ability to grant pardons, prevent the president from ignoring subpoenas or trying to freeze money that, you know, Congress has appropriated or spend money Congress has not appropriated. I'm just wondering if that's, I mean, doesn't the separation of powers prevent Congress from doing that kind of thing?
In the most part, yes. I mean, I think, you know, the president's power to grant pardons is in the Constitution. He can't change that. But, you know, can the president resist subpoenas from Congress? I mean, the Supreme Court is sort of set up to figure out, to, you know, handle those disputes. And I think any law that Congress passes could just be challenged in the Supreme Court. So I don't think that the methods that they've chosen are going to really make much of a difference. You know, if they think Trump's ignoring them, the next Trump, or if it's Trump again, they can just cut off funding for Trump. And they have political weapons they can use. But I don't think just passing a law saying the president has to listen to us is going to change very much.
Did you catch the J6 Justice demonstration in Washington over the weekend?
Well, not in person, thankfully, but I saw it on. I saw the pictures, and it seemed like it was an extremely small crowd.
It was an extremely small
outnumbered crowd. By reporters and police and everything else. So that's good.
But peaceful. You know, I mean,
yes, peaceful. They didn't attack anybody. I think if they did, they would all been just not beaten out of them. But the interesting thing for me is
that's not what the Capitol Police do. They were just,
well, I think that's what they did. They didn't do that on January 6th, but I think they were ready to do it this weekend. But, you know, the question of whether the people who were arrested on January 6th were patriots or whether they were doing the right thing, that's a sadly widely held view among some Republicans. You know, so thankfully they weren't out there trying to bust them out of jail. But I think there's still come some worrying trends in polling about what happened on January 6th, the people having totally wrongheaded ideas about who those people were and what they were doing.
I ask you this almost every week, but what are the chances of another Donald Trump candidacy at this point?
I mean, if I had to bet, I would bet on that he's going to run. I don't see for him, maybe I don't think he's going to announce right now, but I don't see for him the downside of running. I mean, he can raise a bunch of money.
Well, the downside would be that he would ace out any potential new Republican stars who might. I mean, do you think he has a chance of winning if he runs again?
I don't think he has a great chance of winning if he runs again. I mean, I think Biden is kind of at a low ebb right now. Maybe he'll go lower, but even now, I think Biden would beat him. And there's time for Biden to have an economic recovery and to have the end of coronavirus. I don't think Trump could beat him. I think Trump could get the Republican nomination. And the question of whether, you know, Trump will cancel out some rising Republican stars, I mean, Trump doesn't care about that. Why would he want to share the stage and share the money with like Ron DeSantis or something? I could see him trying to name Ron DeSantis as his running mate or something to try to, you know, co-opt that. But, you know, I don't see Trump giving up the stage to anybody if he's healthy enough to run.
David Farenthold, live from the Washington Post. David, thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News.
You can hear us live every morning on 97.3 FM or subscribe to this podcast and you'll never miss the show.